Good morning, family. I find it interesting that in our English language, we have come up with a whole bunch of different words for trials in our lives. Seasons of unpleasantness. Or we might call them challenges. Or we might describe a situation as an ordeal, a period of adversity. Then there's hardship, misfortune, difficulties, suffering, tribulation, series of woes, and on it goes. I haven't even covered idioms like weathering life's storms or sticking it out through thick and thin. We must think about it a lot to come up with all those different kinds of words for the same thing. That also tells us that trials are as much a part of life as birth and death. The Israelite patriarch Jacob was once asked by an Egyptian pharaoh the simple question, "How old are you?" The response Jacob gave was, "The years of my pilgrimage are 130, I think 130 is pretty good myself. My years have been few and difficult. They don't equal the years of the pilgrimage of my fathers," Genesis 47:9. I'm thinking, wow, what a depressing way to describe one's life in answer to the simple question, "How old are you?" I'm thinking maybe Pharaoh regretted he asked. Or there's the cheery statement from Job, kind of the poster child for someone going through suffering, right? He says, "How frail is humanity? How short is life? How full of trouble?" Job 14:1. Now, because Job is such an obvious example of a person who faces adversity in their life, we sometimes overlook another Bible character who faced a string of challenges. As the sermon title indicates, I'm talking about David. According to 1 Samuel 16, David was the youngest of 8 sons born to Jesse of the tribe of Judah who lived in the village of Bethlehem. Now, having 7 older brothers can be a trial in and of itself, right? I mean, mom and dad kind of let the baby of the family get away with all kinds of things, right? I had one of my older ones, you know, charge Diane and I with that once. "Well, you let him get away with a lot more than you let me get away with." And I said, "Honey, you're right. You just wore us out, so we had nothing left." And so that ended that conversation pretty quick. Even so, if mom and dad kind of let the baby get away with things, the older siblings make up for that leniency by tormenting the baby when the parents aren't around, right? So it all, you know, comes out even in the end, I suppose. Now, even though David was the youngest, he was anointed king of Israel by the prophet Samuel. There was only one minor problem. Israel already had a king, Saul of the tribe of Benjamin. This news about David replacing Saul was not going to go down well at the palace. Now, before Saul learned that David would be replacing him, he brought David into his employ, both as a military officer and as kind of a therapist. David was really, really good at playing the lyre, and Saul was going insane. I guess the saying that music calms the savage breast is an old, old, old one, because they brought David in to play on his harp whenever Saul was having one of his episodes, hopefully to calm Saul down. Now, one day when David was doing that, maybe he had a sour note or something that didn't work. Saul picked up a spear and tried to skewer David, not once, but twice. Saul also tried to eliminate David indirectly. He would give him extremely difficult military assignments, hoping that David would get killed carrying out the orders. Now, this put David in kind of a catch-22. If he didn't follow the king's orders, he could be executed for treason. Or he could carry out what was intended to be a suicide mission and hope he survived. Now, in the middle of all of this drama, Saul's son Jonathan, who was a good friend of David, tried to patch things up between the two. And it appeared he was successful. So David was again in the palace, again playing his harp to calm Saul down. When Saul did it again, he reached for a spear and tried to nail David to the wall. I'm thinking, David, if you come in and he's got a spear handy, don't play. Just excuse yourself. But he didn't. So having failed to kill David yet again, David escapes from his presence. Saul sends agents to watch David's house to catch him when he came home to his wife, which, to add another wrinkle to the drama, happened to be Saul's youngest daughter as well. So David decided it was time to get out of Dodge. He went north to the prophet Samuel, who was getting old, instead of going south to the refuge of his family, which is where you might expect him to go. Maybe he went north instead of south to throw Saul off his trail, I don't know. Maybe he was hoping the prophet Samuel could offer a measure of protection. Now, when David went to Samuel, he and Samuel left Samuel's base, the fortified city of Ramah, and went out into the wilderness. The Bible uses a word, Naioth, which is where they went, which means tents. So it sounds like they left a fortified city to hide out in tents in the wilderness. That would have been fine, except some tattletale told King Saul where Samuel and David were hiding. So Saul sent some troops to bring them in. Not once, but twice. Each time, though, there was divine intervention that prevented the soldiers from carrying out their duty. Saul went himself and suffered the same divine intervention that kept him from doing that. We won't get into that because it's PG-13, what God did to them. So, even after all of that, Jonathan again tried to play peacemaker between his dad and David. Except this time, Saul tried to kill his own son. Did the spear thing all over again, but this time with his son, heir to the throne. This was proof enough for Jonathan and David that David just needed to get as far from Saul as possible. So the first thing David tried to do was actually leave Israel and go to the Philistine city of Gath, which turned out to be a mistake, because someone there recognized him as one of King Saul's most successful commanders. They went to arrest him and bring him before the king of Gath. And ironically, David had to pretend he was more insane than King Saul, so that the king of Gath let him go as a complete nut job. Get him out of here. I don't need another one of those. For the rest of Saul's life, he was obsessed with David. So obsessed that he neglected the affairs of state. He didn't protect the borders of Israel while he hunted David all over the land. David spent years running from Saul, hiding in caves, often going hungry, frequently betrayed by his own countrymen who would rat out his present location to Saul. In fact, on more than one occasion, a village that David had saved from raiders. would turn around and let Saul know that David was with them. And that's gratitude for you, right? Now, there were a couple of opportunities David had to kill Saul. Once David and a handful of his men were hiding in a cave, when Saul went into that very same cave to take care of personal business. Now, the men that were with David said, "Hey, this is God's doing. He has put Saul into your hands so you can kill him." But David refused. Whatever kind of man Saul was, in David's mind, he was still the king of Israel, so he wasn't going to take him out. Maybe this was a test of David's character on God's part. We don't know. On another occasion, when the locals had yet again betrayed David's position to Saul, David came upon Saul's camp while everyone was asleep. In fact, God had caused them all to fall into a deep sleep, which enabled David to work his way into the very heart of the camp, where he found the body of King Saul sound asleep. Once more, one of David's soldiers with him said, "This is God's doing. Kill him now. Just pin him to the ground." Once more, David refused. He said in 1 Samuel 26:10-11, "As surely as the Lord lives, the Lord Himself will strike him. Either His time will come and he will die, or he will go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now get the spear and the water jug that are near his head and let's go." Finally, David decided once more that he had to leave Israel completely just to stay safe. And when Saul did finally die in battle, David wasn't immediately recognized as king of all Israel. Instead, according to 2 Samuel 2, there were 7 more years of civil war as Saul's clan and heir fought David for the throne. Okay, up to this point, I've summarized almost the entire last half of the book of 1 Samuel. Now, for those of you who have been going to church since you've been in diapers, you know all this stuff. You've heard it all before. Unless you're Carol or Piper Carol, who's still in diapers and hasn't heard these kinds of stories. But why? Why did I run through this long period of adversity in David's life? Well, I want us to put ourselves in his shoes. Consider for a moment the kinds of physical, psychological, and even spiritual struggles David went through in this period of his life. We can't really tell how long it lasted, but Saul was king for 40 years. This could well have been going on in David's life for 15 to 20 years. And beyond that, since after Saul died, after 40 years as king, there was another 7 years of civil war. So we're talking, let's just estimate, for the sake of argument, 2 decades. 2 decades of what? 2 decades of constant hunger, deprivation, fear, betrayal, death, always lapping at his heels. Don't you think that would wear on someone? They didn't have this internal conflict on those occasions when he could have killed Saul and put an end to all of this, put an end to his pursuer. Should he? Or shouldn't he? And when he didn't, he let Saul know he could have but didn't, in the hopes that Saul would understand, "I'm not after you. I'm not going to kill you to take your throne." And each time that happened, Saul says, "Oh, you're right, I'm so sorry, forgive me, Come on back. I'm going to kill you later. So again, can you imagine how after years of this, how emotionally and physically exhausting this period of adversity must have been for David? Not safe within the borders of Israel. Not safe outside the borders of Israel. Then again, think of the spiritual turmoil that David had to wrestle with in his life. Think of the questions during this period that he must have had for God. Think of the frustrations he must have had toward God. Might David have ever wondered where God was when Saul was trying to murder him yet again? Might David ever have wondered where God was when David was hiding in yet another cave, hungry, exhausted, cold? You know, God told David that he would be the next king. As year after year slipped by on the calendar and that hadn't happened yet, might David have ever wondered how long God was going to let things continue as they were? How long would God let David keep running for his life before God would step in and put an end to this? You don't think David ever asked that? After the first decade of this kind of life rolled around, do you think David might have wrestled with the thought that it would never end? If his life would ever turn a corner for the better? Do you think he ever wondered, can I ever just catch a break, God? Just give me a break. And then Saul dies. Now, given all that's gone on between Saul and David, do you think when Saul died, David might have been tempted to breathe a sigh of relief and think, okay, it's over now. Things are going to get better. Except that Saul's clan and heir rose up against him. They picked up where Saul left off. Another 7 years of dealing with the attacks of Saul's partisans. What would you be experiencing if you went through all that? What kind of emotional and physical and spiritual issues would you be wrestling with in your heart? Especially because these trials have been going on for so stinking long. We actually don't have to guess what David was feeling at such times. All we have to do is read his earlier poems that are in the book of Psalms. A lot of them are pretty raw. Others show that David was wrestling with not only discouragement and despair, but what we might call clinical depression. Psalm 141 is one such poem. It begins describing it as a maskil of David when he was in the cave, a prayer. I cry aloud to the Lord. I lift up my voice to the Lord for mercy. I pour out before Him my complaint. Before Him I tell my trouble. When my spirit grows faint within me, it is You who watch over my way. In the path where I walk, people have hidden a snare for me. Look and see, there is no one at my right hand. No one is concerned for me. I have no refuge. No one cares for my life. I cry to You, Lord. I say, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Listen to my cry, for I am in desperate need. Rescue me from those who pursue me, for they're too strong for me. Set me free from my prison, that I may praise your name. Then the righteous will gather about me because of your goodness to me. Do you hear how he was feeling? He feels trapped. Feels like his life is just a prison. Nobody cares for me. I've got no place to rest. Nowhere to go. It's just too much for me. They're too strong for me. David was a weak human being, just like you and just like me. His trials got him down. Why wouldn't they? He dealt with depression. I mean, think about this. Even when he was on the run from Saul, he usually had about 600 warriors with him, people who sided with David. A lot of them were his relatives. But they were on the run with him as well. They hid in the caves with him. They hid in the wilderness with him. They left Israel with him. And yet he says, I'm all alone. No one cares for me. No one's with me. I got nobody at my right hand. Nobody to give me strength. Nobody? When you got 600 people running around with you and you say you got nobody, that's not reality talking. What is that? That's depression. And depression tends to skew our perception, right? Sometimes, according to this poem, just when David thought he'd found a place of refuge, just when David thought he'd found a season of respite, he'd get a rude awakening. His difficulties would raise their ugly heads, and hardship would begin anew, barely time to catch his breath. Am I describing how anyone else feels besides David? Has anything we've learned about David this morning kind of resonated with you? Kind of describe your life? If not today, a little while ago? Have you ever felt the way David felt in Psalm 141? Do you ever feel like your trials are just going on and on and on, and just when you get over one, here comes another one? I mean, give me a break. Have you been there? This is what I like about the Bible. All these giants of the faith, all these heroes of old, if you take off the rose-colored glasses and actually look at what the Bible says they're dealing with and going through and the way they're acting, they're just us. They're just like us. They had no extra measure of the Spirit or extra whatever to get them through these things. David was a flesh and blood, weak human being who struggled with all kinds of things. A year ago September, I was down at a conference in Springfield, and a psychologist actually took us through David's life and David's poems and said, this guy, he suffered clinical depression. You read some of his poems, and he's got insomnia. And not just insomnia, he's dealing with psychosomatic illnesses as well. This guy needed help. He needed therapy. But weak as David was, all the stuff that was on David's plate, all the things that were weighing him down and causing him discouragement, causing him depression, causing him despair, all those things, and yet he got through them. He endured. He survived. He even, if you read his poems, even the poems that are pretty raw, somewhere in there, he finds a reason to praise God. Somewhere within himself, he finds the ability to praise God in the middle of his trials. And he found ways to renew his trust and his hope in God. And what's good for us is that David chronicled his journey through all of these struggles, letting us know what he was experiencing, letting us know what he was feeling, going through. And I think one of the reasons God had those poems preserved is so that others who are going through the same kinds of things, struggling with the same kinds of emotions, the same spiritual questions about why God, that down through the centuries, others who go through trials could look to these poems, look to the life of David, and first off, find permission to tell God what we're really feeling, instead of pretending we're not experiencing it and pretending God doesn't know. He knows when we're mad at Him. He knows when we're bitter. He knows when we're wondering where He is and what He's doing. We feel like He's forgotten us. Isn't it interesting that when Jesus was facing the greatest trial of His life, when Jesus was experiencing the greatest suffering a human can endure up there on the cross, where did He go to express His feelings? As He hung up on the cross, did He not cry out, "My God, my God, I love You so much. Thank You for these trials going on in my life." Is that what He said? The Son of God, in the midst of His pain and suffering, cried out, "My God, my God, why have You abandoned Me?" Where did He get those words? Psalm 22, written by David. David felt abandoned by God. And Jesus felt abandoned by God. So if Jesus could say it and David could say it, can't you say it? Isn't it okay? If that's what you're feeling, to say, "God, this has been going on for years. Please, why have You abandoned me?" Well, he hasn't. Keep reading the poem and they work it out. But it's okay. They were weak human beings, David and these others we read about in the Bible. They were flesh and blood, just like you and I. They experienced the same spiritual, emotional, and physical struggles that you and I face. But they made it through. And they relied on God to make it through. So I'm trying to tell you, family, as dark as it may seem, whatever you're going through, as long as you've been going through it, if David made it through it, you can make it through too. Turn to their words for guidance. Turn to their words for strength. Turn to their words for permission to scream at God. It's in there. Thank you for listening, family. We come to a time of our service that we set aside for sharing. No one knows what you're going through. No one. Although we all face similar trials, we're different people, we handle them differently, they impact us differently. You may feel that you're dealing with it all alone, just like David said. You don't have to. Let us lift you up. Lift you up in prayer. Lend you our encouragement. Lend you our strength. We can't do that if we don't know. We can't know if you don't tell us. Now in a moment we're going to stand and sing. And you're welcome to come down front here. I'll visit with you. I'll share what you want shared with the congregation, and we'll lift you up in prayer. That may be just a little too public. That's okay. I mean, frankly, a group this size, there's people in here who can't handle what you're going through at this particular season in their life. Pull someone aside that you trust. Talk to someone you're comfortable around and ask them to lift you up in prayer. If you have any need, we invite you to make it known as we stand and sing.
Be with me, Lord, I cannot live without Thee. I dare not try to take one step alone. I cannot bear the loads of life unaided. I need Thy strength to lean myself upon. Be with me, Lord, and then if dangers threaten, if storms of trial burst above my head, if lashing seas leap everywhere about me, they cannot harm or make my heart afraid. blessing thou couldst bestow could with this one compare. A constant sense of thy abiding presence where'er I am, to feel that thou art near. Be with me, Lord, when loneliness o'ertakes me, when I must weep amid the fires of pain, and when shall come the hour of my departure, for worlds unknown, O Lord, be there.